In addition to Zaporizhia
and health,
the facilities in Novoronezh,
for those living near nuclear reactors,
there are often nagging concerns about the health impact of radioactive emissions that come from both normal operations and possible accidents, and what this does to local residents, most specifically the children. While so-called experts like to dismiss the public's concerns with a, "There, there, Missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it," many heads are reasonably worried about it and concerned and want more than slick talking points and dismissive attitudes with absolutely nothing to back them up. It takes a genuine expert, someone who has spent decades examining the impact of radiation on everything from baby teeth to cancer rates, and explain that from the start,
beginning in the 1950s, nuclear power plants and power reactors were built. The regulations were set to include the following: that any company that owned and operated a reactor had to produce information on how much radiation was being released into the environment and how much was found in the environment, the air and the water and the soil and so forth. There was nothing in there about monitoring the health of people living near nuclear reactors.
What better way to hide a problem than not look for it? Well, when Joseph Mangano, an epidemiologist and head of Radiation and Public Health Project, points out this and all the other ways the nuclear power operators have gamed their way out of responsibility for even checking on the health of their closest human neighbors, you get a sneaking suspicion that maybe, just maybe, they're trying to cover up exactly how bad it is for us who are stuck in that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, important information if you're concerned about your health and you live near a nuclear reactor, which could be anywhere within a 50-mile radius of one. How bad might contamination of your immediate environment be from routine operations, so-called permissible emissions, let alone accidents? And why don't we know these risks? We learn a wealth of information on the problem and the need for a solution before new nuclear reactors are built from Joseph Mangano. He is an epidemiologist and head of Radiation and Public Health Project, a nonprofit educational and scientific organization established by scientists and physicians dedicated to understanding the relationships between low-level nuclear radiation exposure and public health. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons with the ICAN update, and more honest nuclear information than was heard in all of last Saturday's No Kings rallies combined, because that wasn't the subject we were addressing. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 21st, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out the news this week with a headline we don't get a chance to see often enough. We won one! Here's Linda Pence Gunter to explain it all on this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
It can be hard to score a win in the anti-nuclear movement, Most often when a victory comes, here's what it looks like. Nothing happened. This can be a hard sell to funders and not exactly an enticing recruitment tool. We can't brag about saving 250 puppies from a meat farm last year or feeding 100 hungry children last month, noble though these causes are and efforts I fully support. Maintaining the status quo? Not so exciting. But that's mostly what we strive to do. Make sure no new reactors are built, no licenses are extended for operating reactors, no new uranium mines are opened, no new environmentally unjust and geologically unsound radioactive waste dumps are approved. That said, these are victories when they happen, and important ones, and we scored one last week. That is when Holtec, the company trying to build a temporary parking lot-style radioactive waste dump in a predominantly Latinx community in New Mexico, finally threw in the towel and pulled the project. We do need to celebrate this because it is yet another example not only of citizen mobilization and the desperately useless economics of the entire nuclear power sector, but also of the glaring reality that the radioactive waste problem has not been solved since the first cupful was generated in 1942, and likely never will be. We've stopped nuclear waste dumps before, at Yucca Mountain on western Shoshone land in Nevada, where there was supposed to be a deep geological repository, at Utah's Skull Valley Goshute Indian Reservation, an earlier but cancelled destination for an outdoor nuclear waste dump. At least 13 Native American tribal councils have been courted at one time or another to host nuclear waste, big bribes dangling before communities desperately in need of funds and resources, but not a multiple generations-long legacy of lethal radioactive waste. Do you notice a pattern here, that US nuclear waste policy is rife with racism? Holtec is supposed to be a reactor decommissioning company, but these days it has become a sort of nuclear chameleon, presenting itself as all things to all projects atomic. Build a nuclear waste surface repository? That's us, says Holtec. New small modular reactors? We'll make them. Send pseudo-military commandos, and no disrespect, but slightly over-the-hill-looking ones, judging by the group photo, to defend a nuclear plant against a mock attack? We'll do it. Holtec's scheme, along with Eddie Lee Energy Alliance in New Mexico, was to construct and operate the world's largest high-level radioactive waste dump. Opening the dump would not only have put local communities at risk, it would have triggered thousands of lethal transports, mainly from the eastern half of the United States, which is home to the preponderance of nuclear power plants, putting that deadly cargo on our roads, rails, and waterways, endangering millions of Americans. For my forthcoming book to be published next March, No to Nuclear: Why Nuclear Power Destroys Lives, Derails Climate Progress, and Provokes War, I investigated just how dangerous radioactive waste transportation might be. I learned that there are close to 500,000 police-reported truck accidents on US roads each year, and an average of 1,000 train derailments on freight lines, more than three a day, according to the Federal Railroad Administration. You only have to recall the February 3, 2023 freight train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, with its cargo of hazardous materials including hydrogen chloride and phosgene that led to mass evacuations and a fire that burned for several days, or the massive July 18, 2001 freight train crash inside the Baltimore Railroad Tunnel in Maryland that sparked a raging chemical fire. To understand how many orders of magnitude more serious those disasters would have been were radioactive waste involved. Beyond Nuclear and a coalition of grassroots, Latinx and indigenous groups fought long and hard, in court and in the community, to oppose Holtec's New Mexico dump. It feels good to win one, but we know it's not over. The radioactive waste is still at the reactor sites, where operators and residents are eager to see it gone, even though it has nowhere to go. Holtec will almost certainly try again. The search for a geological repository has not been abandoned. When we are asked at Beyond Nuclear what we think should be done with nuclear waste, we point out that those who made the mess, the nuclear companies and the governments that subsidize them, hold the primary responsibility to solve the problem, not ordinary citizens. But we also always say the first step toward finding a solution to radioactive waste is not to make any more of it. That's a victory we are yet to celebrate. I'm Linda Pence Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In Ukraine, repairs have begun on the power lines supplying the Zaporizhia 6-reactor nuclear power plant after a 4-week outage. On September 23rd, Energoatom reported the 10th blackout at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. According to the company, the Russian occupiers are deliberately preventing the plant from reconnecting to Ukraine's power grid. The plant switched to emergency power from diesel generators, but those generators have, on average, only 10 days' worth of fuel before they run out. And without the power from the emergency diesel generators, there's a risk of meltdown and major radiation release. The International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed that after the plant was disconnected from external power sources, the site remains in a critical nuclear safety situation. Local ceasefire zones had to be established in order to allow the work to proceed. In addition to Zaporizhia, the facilities in Novovoronezh and Chernobyl have been attacked with drones and bombings. At Chernobyl, an attack caused a power outage, which was stabilized thanks to backup generators. The International Atomic Energy Agency has documented the attacks and warns that any nuclear accident would have catastrophic consequences. Now, with the latest on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, direct from the headquarters of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons in Geneva, Switzerland, here's the ICAN update.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett from ICAN in Geneva with the latest news from the campaign. Nuclear weapons news over the past few weeks has been dominated by the diplomatic dance between Iran and the US over whether they'll restart talks on Iran's nuclear program that were broken off when the US joined Israel in attacking Iran's nuclear facilities in July. Iran has signalled it's ready to talk again if the US accepts it can continue to enrich uranium, which the US has so far been unwilling to do. Iran has applied pressure by limiting access to its sites to the IAEA inspectors. Senior figures in Iran have also raised the possibility that if the US doesn't compromise, Iran should leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which would probably trigger another wave of proliferation, with Saudi Arabia and other countries following suit, and potentially deal a fatal blow to the NPT. If Iran were to leave the treaty, it would almost certainly lead to Israel and possibly the Americans attacking it again, and further conflict and instability in the Middle East, which is the last thing the region needs. Neither Israel nor the US has legal grounds for attacking Iran. Two nuclear-armed states attacking a country that even US intelligence agencies say doesn't have nuclear weapons and has not made the decision to develop them is completely unjustified and irresponsible. It's likely to make it more possible Iran does decide to develop nuclear weapons. The nuclear deal that Trump abrogated in his first term was the best guarantee Iran would not develop weapons. The sequence of events that began with that unnecessary decision has brought us to today. In the past few weeks, there have been more nuclear threats and so-called nuclear signalling, which imply threats. President Trump responded to social media posts by Russia's former president, Medvedev, by saying he'd ordered nuclear missile submarines closer to Russia. Pakistan's military commander reminded India of the nuclear forces under his command. India responded by carrying out a ballistic missile test. China and the US have been sending each other blatant signals. In the first, China released a video of its latest nuclear missile submarine and displayed its new ICBM that can hit all of the US at its military parade to commemorate the end of World War II. For its part, the US reportedly surfaced 3 different nuclear missile submarines in separate waters near China, where Beijing is actively projecting its power. All these activities are irresponsible, and all countries need to come to their senses and stop escalating nuclear tensions. Particularly at this time, when we have been commemorating the use of nuclear weapons in war for the first time in 1945. One of the themes of the commemorations to mark this 80th anniversary of the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki has been the need for the Hibakusha, whose average age is now 86, to pass on the memory of their experience of what happens when nuclear weapons are used to younger generations. ICAN has been running a campaign called Cranes of Memory on social media. But another thing we do is to run a paid summer intern program for younger people. This summer, Siham Maksumwood, who is a postgraduate student in international relations at the University of Geneva, worked with us on policy and advocacy. I spoke to her at the end of her internship to see what she had got out of it and how the campaign can attract more support from younger people.
I feel like a part of the team and that the work that I'm doing is meaningful. I often get asked my opinion on different topics, on tasks, and which I believe is very important for an intern because it really helps to build our own confidence and makes you feel like your input really matters. I believe that young people have a voice, and so far that's exactly how I've felt in this internship.
And what have you found to be most useful in working on the actual campaign itself?
Doing research with Alicia and to support advocacy work with Florian. So that has been really, really valuable to me, particularly in Switzerland. Since Switzerland still hasn't signed the TPNW, and I had the chance to really go into the streets to collect signatures in order to push the parliament to ratify the treaty. So talking to people, explaining why this campaign is really important, why it matters for global security and peace, that was really meaningful experience for me.
Now, some people say that young people are apathetic about the nuclear threat. Do you think that the campaign can do more to engage with younger people?
I don't really think that young people are apathetic about nuclear threats. I just think that most of us still haven't had the chance to really learn about the campaign itself. Before I started working with ICANN, none of my friends, neither me, had even heard of the TPNW, but when I asked them what they thought about nuclear weapons, everyone was strongly against them. But we are part of a generation that is likely going to change society in itself. Gen Z, there's a lot of study that was made about Gen Z changing the societies way faster than other generations, mostly because we are very deeply engaged with social and global issues. Like you can see it in the world right now happening either with Palestine or Congo or Sudan, all of those issues that really pushes Gen Z to go in the street and protest. All of those protests are organized by Gen Z. So I think in order for the campaign to really be, I would say, more known, we really have to engage youth and young people because with us, I believe the TPNW can even go further.
Now, you've been working chiefly on advocacy work. How have you found the message about the treaty has gone down with the parliamentarians, with diplomats that you've had contact with while you've been working here?
I found that it's quite complicated, especially in NATO countries, because even though individuals are really for the TPNW, they work in a country that is totally against it. So it's kind of... it's very complicated and it's hard, but I appreciate working with people who I have the same vision and the same value with, and people who internally in their own countries really try to make a difference. And so I think it's very empowering as a young person to see that even when you're working in a system that is totally against, like for instance, signing the TPNW, as an individual, you have a voice in making sure that your voice is heard within the parliament. Either working with, I would say, civil societies to make sure that society's voice is heard in the parliament is very empowering and inspiring as well.
That was Siham Maksumwood. As she said, she's been working on getting more countries to sign the TPNW, the UN Nuclear Ban Treaty. In the face of all the worrying recent nuclear developments, the treaty is the only bright spot, and this month at the UN General Assembly, we're very hopeful more countries will sign and ratify the treaty, which will mean a majority of the world's countries are on board. This is Alistair Burnett, ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, traveling to cover nuclear events is an important part of my work with Nuclear Hot Seat. Earlier this year, thanks to the generosity of you, the listeners, I was able to be in New York to cover the third meeting of states' parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. In September, I attended the Westheimer Peace Symposium held at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, under the aegis of the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center. That was the subject of last week's show. Now, There's one final trip I need to take in 2025. This time, to the International Uranium Film Festival, being held November 13 and 14 in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, Arizona. It's an in-gathering of filmmakers, films, activists, cabaret artists, with strong indigenous representation and leadership. I have attended the three previous IUFFs in Navajo Nation, as well as gatherings in Rio, Quebec City, and Las Vegas. I intend to return to Window Rock again this year to not only view the films, but to network with those who oppose nuclear and gain insight into their issues for future shows. Being on site helps extend the reach of any event I cover to where it is not just posted and broadcast for a brief period of time, but held in archive for future research. The challenge I face is the same as always. I need to raise the money to cover my expenses, travel, ground transportation, housing, and meals. This is over and above the monthly costs of running Nuclear Hot Seat, and the only possible source of these necessary funds is you. If you can help me get there to cover the IUFF at Window Rock for Nuclear Hot Seat, please consider making a donation. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button, then follow the prompts. If you like, you can earmark it for IUFF or Film Festival. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible, and we make it easy. Red button, follow prompts, fill them in, you got it. Or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. One of the nuclear industry's favorite ways to hide the negative impacts of operating a power reactor is to just not look for any problems. It's a method the industry's been using to fool the public since the very first reactors were being built in the 1950s. Today's guest is an epidemiologist, a professional who studies the distribution, patterns, and determinants of health and disease conditions in populations. They analyze data and work to develop strategies for prevention and control of health issues. When it comes to nuclear, one of the very few people in the world who not only knows how to search for hidden health impacts, but is transparent in both methodology and publication of results, is epidemiologist Joseph Mangano. He is head of Radiation and Public Health Project, a nonprofit educational and scientific organization established by scientists and physicians dedicated to understanding the relationships between low-level nuclear radiation and public health. Here, Mangano takes us through the many ways that the nuclear industry has ducked out of providing information on the health impact in communities around its existing reactors, and why it is necessary, why we must conduct studies on radiation health impact on residents who live in proximity to nuclear reactors before any new ones are built. I spoke with Joseph Mangano on October 17, 2025. Joseph Mangano, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's so glad to be back again.
Always great to have you. A recent article that's been published that was written by you and the late Bob Alvarez calls for a national cancer study on U.S. nuclear reactors before there are any new expansions of nuclear power. Now, I would assume that this kind of study would be normal and routine and regular before any step ahead was made on any nuclear project. What's wrong with that assumption?
What's wrong is that in the now 80 years of the atomic era and that we've been operating nuclear reactors, there has been exactly one study of health near nuclear power plants in the U.S.
When was that and what were the findings?
It was done in the late 1980s. It was only done because Senator Edward Kennedy insisted on it being done. He wrote a letter to the National Institutes of Health. He was the head of the health committee in the Senate. and the National Cancer Institute found no link between living close to nuclear reactors and greater risk of cancer.
So this was done in 1988, and it was 2 years until the study was released. That's still not that long after nuclear reactors were out. And we all know that radiation has long-term effects and cumulative effects. How accurate or how thorough do you feel that this study was for the time?
For the time is the key phrase, because it is very, very much outdated. There are no data in it beyond 1984. So we're 40 years behind. It was a good first attempt because it looked at cancer mortality near 62 U.S. nuclear plants. Unfortunately, they included only four nuclear plants with cancer incidence data, the actual cases, because those were the only states in which had them.
Why is relatively little known about the risk of cancer and other diseases from exposure to nuclear reactors and reactor emissions?
The answer to why we have done virtually no studies begins at the beginning of the atomic era. Even before the atomic era, before the atomic bomb, when the Manhattan Project was underway, but before the bombs were used on Japan, there was a concern that the bomb would fail, that it wouldn't work. They were running reactors and they were creating radioactive waste, 100 different chemicals not ever found in nature, only when you split the uranium atoms. These are all, of course, dangerous and cancer-causing. In May 1943, Robert Oppenheimer, who ran the project, wrote a letter to Enrico Fermi, another famous physicist on the project. And he told Fermi that he was concerned that the project might fail. But he proposed that if it failed, that some of the waste, specifically radioactive strontium, could be used to poison the food supply of Nazi Germany. In fact, the quote is, "I think we should not attempt a plan unless we can poison food sufficient to kill 500,000 men." This letter was kept secret from the public for 40 years, but in 1985 it was released and it is all over the internet now and very easily readable. So the point is, they knew that this was dangerous. So if you take that and you move forward and you see that in the beginning of the 1950s, nuclear power plants and power reactors were built. The regulations were set to include the following, that any company that owned and operated a reactor had to produce information on how much radiation was being released into the environment and how much was found in the environment, the air and the water and the soil and so forth. There was nothing in there about health, about monitoring the health of people living near nuclear reactors. In fact, the architects of the reactors then and now set what they called permissible limits of emissions and environmental levels. And as long as the emissions and environment levels were below those limits, not only could the reactor continue operating and keep its license, but the officials declared it to be safe. And their basis was that low levels were not harmful.
This raises the question, who set those limits? What did they use to determine that, oh, this is okay for you to do? And were those limits ever challenged through the years? Or it's just kind of like, we decided it's okay, go run with it.
Originally, it was federal regulators, the Atomic Energy Commission. And the basis for these limits were the findings of what happened to the people who survived the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was a poor use of science because it was a different type of exposure, a single blast, as opposed to living near a nuclear reactor where every single day some of the radiation created is released. Most of it is stored, but some is released, and it gets to you again and again. And more than that, it did not account for certain segments of the population are more susceptible to the harms from radiation. The fetus, the infant, the young child are much more susceptible than adults. There's another one. People with immune system diseases are another one. The very elderly whose immune systems are failing.
And based on the work of Mary Olson and Generational Radiation Impact Project, or GRIP, we know that radiation is more damaging to women than to men.
It was just one size fits all. It's an example of make a declaration, but you don't back it up. There was no proof that these reactors were operating safely, other than we think below a certain level, it's safe. Of course, over the years, there have been a number of studies of low-level radiation, not near nuclear reactors, because, first of all, the fear of political backlash if a researcher published studies, but also because doses were not made public by the companies, the private companies that ran nuclear reactors. There were studies near nuclear weapons plants, which were run by the federal government, and information was public. They found, of course, that exposures to the workers, the higher they went, the more the risk of cancer. But no study has ever been done, even of workers in nuclear electric plants, power plants, and certainly not people living near them.
You spoke about the earliest studies being done on nuclear weapons workers. How far back did this start, and what was discovered?
In the 1970s, several eminent researchers, Dr. Alice Stewart from Oxford University, and Dr. Thomas Mancuso from the University of Pittsburgh, found high levels of cancer, of risk of cancer in workers at the Hanford plant in the state of Washington, which was a major facility in producing nuclear weapons. And of course, they found that the higher the dose, the greater the risk of dying of cancer. That was made clear by the 1970s.
That was done by the Atomic Energy Commission, which was in charge at that point. What did they do with that report?
It was used eventually to compensate employees and workers at nuclear weapons plants. In 2000, Congress passed the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Program, which has since compensated over 100,000 workers. Other than that, the game continued. You know, we continued to make weapons and continued to produce electrical power from nuclear reactors.
And produce the waste and produce the emissions, which pile up and have not decayed down to where they are neutral, where they're not going to do any harm.
Right.
So in this article that you wrote in 1999, the can was kicked to a different government agency from the AEC, and that was NIOSH, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. By 1999, what were their findings? Were they any different, or did they just reconfirm the same?
Well, NIOSH only dealt with workers at nuclear plants. They did not deal at all with people living near nuclear plants, which far, far more people living locally than people who work in plants.
And have those people, have the general public been accounted for and taken into consideration and studied at all in all the years since we've had nuclear?
Until the 1980s, you could count on one hand the number of articles published in peer-reviewed scientific journals that addressed this topic. In fact, one of them was done in 1987 by an epidemiology professor, Richard Clapp from Boston University, who found a high incidence of leukemia in towns closest to the Pilgrim nuclear power plant in Massachusetts. And it was that study that made its way to Senator Kennedy's desk, Ted Kennedy's desk, and he turned around and asked, more than asked, he insisted that the National Cancer Institute do a national study. I do want to make a point about that study and before it happened. And the point is this. In January 1988, Ted Kennedy wrote a letter to the director of the National Institutes of Health saying that we really need to study this issue. 3 weeks later, he gets a letter back. And the letter from the NIH director said, yes, we have started that study already. But it also contained several disturbing sentences. The NIH director was Dr. James Wingarden. And Wingarden turned the attention of the letter to Three Mile Island, Three Mile Island, of course, was the site of the 1979 accident, only 9 years prior. And it was still on the minds of lots of Americans. Wingarden made the statement that the most serious impact, and I'm quoting, the most serious impact of the Three Mile Island accident that can be identified with certainty is mental stress to those living closest to the plant, particularly pregnant women and those with teenagers and young children. That is a disturbing statement because at that point, no studies had been done looking at what happened to cancer rates near Three Mile Island after the meltdown.
That's also a very short period of time because it can take multiple years, decades, for the impact of the radiation to show up. Cause and effect are separated by a great distance, but it doesn't mean that they're not connected. It just means it takes longer than they put in this time span to find out what actually happened.
It can be much longer. You're absolutely right. And for him to make a statement like that is biased. It showed that the study was biased from the get-go.
So the picture I'm getting, and right now we're bringing it up to 1999, is that the government really wasn't interested in finding out the impact of leaks, accidents, whatever could be released from nuclear reactors that might harm the people who lived in proximity with them. Were there studies taking place elsewhere in the world at this point?
There were very few studies done on this topic, on cancer near nuclear power plants. There were more studies done near nuclear weapons plants, but the nuclear power plants were very few in number. That changed after the Chernobyl meltdown in 1986, where a number of studies appeared in the peer-reviewed literature showing increased rates of cancer and other diseases near Chernobyl. However, this was not correlated by not just federal officials, but worldwide officials. For a long time, the World Health Association used the number 31. 31 people died at Chernobyl. 31 of the liquidators who helped put out the fire and got exposed to huge doses died pretty soon after that. Later on, they changed their minds and said, okay, 4,000, we believe 4,000 cancers occurred because of Chernobyl. There are other studies, particularly really a book done by a group of Russian scientists led by Alexei Yablokov, who looked at 5,000 studies, most of them that had been published, most of them in the Russian language, and they concluded that instead of 4,000 additional cancers, they estimated about 1 million additional deaths occurred only in the first 20 years after Chernobyl. That study was done in 2009. So you can believe that the number is higher than that now. So again, the key here is the reticence of regulators and health leaders to even address this issue. And when it does come up, there is an equal reticence to accurately calculating how many people have been harmed.
Just supposition. If you believe the numbers were fairly accumulated and crunched, and we knew the results, what do you think the impact might be on the nuclear industry?
There's no question. We have had 130 reactors operate in this country. We're down to 94 now. Some have closed for now almost 70 years, the oldest ones. And some of these are near big cities, near large populations. The Indian Point plant, for example, it's just north of New York City, within 50 miles, 17 million people. It just closed recently after almost 60 years of operation. The death toll would be high. How high? It's impossible to calculate without doing the studies.
There was a big study announced in May of 2009 that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was going to conduct an updated analysis of cancer near U.S. nuclear plants. What happened to that study?
The study was announced by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as a total surprise to everybody. To that point, the NRC had completely ignored the health issue. One day in the Federal Register came an announcement, we want this study of cancer near nuclear plants done. Without any competitive bidding, they selected a group from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the Oak Ridge Institute for Science and Education, which is very much connected to the nuclear weapons program. After a large outcry, they rescinded their offer to Oak Ridge and instead selected the National Academy of Sciences, who had a committee to do this. For the next 7 years, there were a number of meetings and discussions and two large reports done, not with any findings, but just preparatory work. And 7 years later came another surprise. The NRC announced they were canceling the study after 7 years and after, I think, $10 million, because they said the additional amounts required, $8 million to do a study, would be too high. And again, this is a damning phrase, quote, the releases were too small to cause measurable harm in the population. You can't make that assumption without doing the studies first. Maybe it's true, but that shows a bias which has been with us since the beginning of the atomic age.
You know, there seems to be this assumption, it's like a gun. You fire a gun, the bullet hits something, there's immediate damage, you can see it, there's blood. When nuclear radiation hits a person, it can bounce off, it can go partway in, it can go through, it can get lodged inside the body. But the danger is from the ongoing spray of neutrons that cut through. It's like having a machine gun firing these little invisible bullets inside your body. And over time, that creates enough damage that you get tumors, you get other impacts on health. And they're not taking into account the period of time. One of the quotes from the article that you released is that the NRC issued a statement that they, quote, and state agencies regularly analyze environmental samples from near the plants, and these analyses show the releases, when they occur, are too small to cause observable, important word there, too small to cause observable increases in cancer risks near the facilities. Well, where are they looking and for how long are they looking and what's their persistence of vision?
That's very nice, but prove it. Show me the studies that prove it. In fact, for the last several decades, there has been a blue ribbon panel called BEER, B-E-I-R, the Committee on the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation. It's a blue ribbon panel. These are very highly regarded professors and academics and physicians and epidemiologists. And they produce a report about every decade or so. Their 1990 report, BEER 5, was a hugely important one because they looked at something like 900 studies. The book is thick with references, people that have looked at low-dose radiation. And they found conclusively that even at low doses, radiation causes harm. Call it the linear no-threshold dose relationship, which is a lot of big fancy words, but again, it means even at low doses, there's more harm with high doses, of course, but even at low doses. And that also makes sense with other toxic products. I mean, if you smoke three packs of cigarettes a day, no one's going to argue that there is a risk to one's health. But if you smoke three cigarettes a day, well, your risk is lower, but there's still a risk. Okay. It's just very unfortunate that they continue to take this stand, but if and when the truth is really known, the numbers are going to be large. These 100 plus chemicals produced in reactors, the same produced when bombs explode, are arguably the most toxic of any man-made chemical on the planet.
One of the many previous interviewees I've had on Nuclear Hot Seat is Dr. Ian Fairley, who is Canadian, but he does most of his work, it seems, in the UK. He has had several studies that show that child cancer rate, specifically thyroid cancer and leukemia in proximity to nuclear reactors is much higher. Is that research that either the United States has drawn upon or that your group, Radiation and Public Health Project, has drawn upon in putting forth your message?
Yes, Dr. Fairley's results are similar to the results found by our group, Radiation and Public Health Project, which was founded specifically because of this desert, this dearth of studies near U.S. nuclear plants.
How long have you been operating, and what are some of the studies that have been conducted by our PHP?
The group began in the late 1980s. We have produced over 40 articles in peer-reviewed medical journals and numerous other reports. Many of the findings show basically the same thing, that when a nuclear plant begins operating, the cancer rate is often at the same level as the national rate, or just or maybe slightly below. These are often in, located in suburban counties. But as time goes on, the gap grows between the local and the US rate much, much faster. And this has occurred near numerous sites: the Salem plant in New Jersey, the Indian Point plant in New York, the Portsmouth, well, it's not a power plant, but it's a uranium enrichment plant, Palisades plant in Michigan, Fermi in Michigan, Dresden in Illinois, and more. They basically all show pretty much the same. And of course, the children have it worst. We did a study in 2003 looking at areas near 14 nuclear power plants in the East. And over a 10-year period, the childhood cancer rate exceeded the US rate for 14 out of 14. So the statement that we don't know very much about cancer in nuclear plants in the US is no longer true. However, we still need a much broader study.
Which brings us to a central proposal from this article. You state that a national study of health risks posed by existing reactors needs to take place. So, to create such a study, what are your recommendations? What needs to be covered?
Any sort of a study, national study of cancer in nuclear plants should, first of all, look at the changes over time in deaths, in cancer deaths near nuclear plants, which the original study in the late 80s did. It needs to be updated. That's the minimum. Number two, there needs to be not just that mortality from all cancers combined, but from specific types of cancers, especially those that are known to be especially susceptible to radiation. Thyroid cancer and leukemia, breast cancer are among them. Number three, there needs to be a thorough look at the incidence of cancer near nuclear plants, incidence being the rate of newly diagnosed cancers. For a long time, only a few states in this country had cancer registries. Well, time went on and cancer became more and more of an issue. And now every single one of the 50 states has a comprehensive cancer registry, which records every single new case of cancer. And a lot of the data are now available on the internet, but the registries themselves contain much more detailed data, looking at different types of cancers and what ages are they diagnosed. Incidence is arguably more important than mortality because some cancers are treatable, all right, and the survival rate is high. And several of them are the ones that are susceptible to radiation. And I mentioned two of them: childhood cancer and thyroid cancer. Years ago, childhood cancer was a death sentence, all right? There was nothing to do. Now, treatments such as radiation and chemotherapy allow kids to survive more than 5 years, much more than 5 years. So you won't see them in the death statistics, but you will see them in the incidence. Same thing with thyroid cancer. I think the 10-year survival rate is like 96% or something like that. Very few people die of thyroid cancer. But of course, that's no excuse for ignoring incidents because even the survivors suffer from the disease and from the treatments. And the final thing I would say that there should be a specific look at children with cancer. Again, we know the most susceptible ages to a dose of radiation are the fetal period, infancy, and early childhood. And they are most likely to show up in the early years of life. Put it another way, you can look more broadly just in radiation. In the last 50 years, the national rate of cancer in newly diagnosed cases, people under 40 years old, is up 50%, right? For kids and adults, it's a little under 50%. And for people in their 20s and 30s, it's a little over 50%. That is outrageous. Most people aren't aware of it. That should be declared a national crisis, and causes should be found immediately. These are people, and it's not better diagnosis. No child or teenager or young adult is required to be screened, you know, like older adults are, for any cancer. So it's got to be something else, or be multiple factors. That should be a focus of a national study, the young.
Given the money and power and influence of the nuclear industry and how entwined they are with the government, if such a study would be carried out and the results would show, as you and I would expect, that the cancer rates are higher and that they can be traced and connected with proximity to nuclear reactors or other nuclear sites, but nuclear reactors in particular, what's the chance that that information will get out in a full and transparent way so that the public can be exposed to it and then take that as their start point for any further influence or decisions that get made about new nuclear?
If such a study would be done, it certainly would need to be supported by the federal government, but also the actual conduct of the study should not be done by government and government employees. It should only be done by independent experts in epidemiology and medicine who are experts in publishing articles on the health effects of radiation. That's the only way we're going to get to a objective understanding of just what this nuclear power program has caused.
What can we, the public, do to help bring about a study of this sort?
The only way a study addressing this issue is going to be done is from the bottom up, not top down. It has to be done after the insistence of grassroots groups who will persuade leaders to commission such a study. This was done, of course, with Edward Kennedy. He found out about the study and people in Massachusetts were upset about it. And the study was done, but it was done by federal government workers. I think a better analogy would be the involving another one of the Kennedys, and that is during the era of above-ground atomic bomb testing, which spread the same dangerous fallout all across the country and was getting into children's bodies and was concerning. The public pressured officials to stop the testing for a number of years, even though many officials wanted the test to continue above the ground. But it wasn't until people led by President John F. Kennedy and other government leaders persuaded the Senate to vote for the Test Ban Treaty of 1963, which banned all above-ground tests from the U.S., Soviet Union, and the U.K., which basically saved millions of lives had the tests continued. And they did this through a variety of ways. They had education in schools, and there were magazine articles that Kennedy had asked for, and different groups, community groups, and it was picked up by media. And finally, the Senate was persuaded, and the senators were getting more and more letters like, vote for this test ban treaty. That, I think, is what's going to have to happen to get a study like this done.
And of course, one of the major factors in pushing for that test ban treaty was based on the study of strontium-90 in baby teeth, the famous baby tooth study, which you and I have discussed extensively on this show. And I will link to an episode I have that's completely on it because there's a new set of work that's taking place on the teeth. Am I right?
Yes, it is a work that's being done by our group with the help of 100,000 baby teeth collected in the 1950s and 60s by scientists and citizens in St. Louis, but not used in their original study, but donated to us. These are people now mostly in their 60s. We are doing a follow-up health study to see if people who died of cancer had higher levels of strontium-90 from bomb fallout than people who are still alive and healthy.
That's a study I can't wait to read. One final question. This article was written by you and Bob Alvarez, who passed away just last July 1st. Was this the last paper that we're going to be seeing from him?
I believe it was. Bob told me that he was waiting for another paper he had written from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, but I think that came first. And this one was published on September 12th, 2025, several months after he passed away. So this likely was his last official article in a very storied career that lasted a long time.
One of our greats.
Indeed.
Joseph Mangano, Joe, you are always a great source of information, reliable information, confirmable information. And I want to thank you for speaking with us today and being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure to be here, Libby. Thank you.
Epidemiologist Joseph Mangano. He is the head of Radiation and Public Health Project with the web address radiation.org. We will have a link up to that, as well as a link to the article that he co-wrote with the late Bob Alvarez on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 747.
Activists, shout out.
Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, CCNR, has produced a new video, which is an introduction to radioactivity with special emphasis on uranium. Uranium is where all the other radioactive isotopes begin, and Dr. Edwards is a superb communicator when it comes to getting across the points and not confusing you. It's posted on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 747. A big thanks to Chuck Lind for his blog shout-out to Nuclear Hot Seat. In an article entitled Nuclear News Blackout, for ways to get around the blackout, he did more than just mention Nuclear Hot Seat. He included the logo and a write-up that included, quote, Libby Halevi produces a terrific podcast weekly newsletter called Nuclear Hot Seat. This is where you will find quality news, expert interviews, and an unabashed oppositional perspective on weapons, reactors, radioactive waste production, taxpayer bailouts to for-profit nuclear corporations, and all other aspects of the industry. That would be accurate. Thank you for noticing. We will link to his blog, which is on medium.com, so you can find this extraordinary recognition of the show yourself. And we will also be posting the link to Carl Grossman's Enviro Close-Up, where he features a full-length interview with me about Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, my play, about Nuclear Hot Seat, about 3 Mile Island, and a whole bunch of other stuff, too. It's nice to be noticed and acknowledged, so thank you, Carl. We'll have more about this program in the coming week. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 21st, 2025. The best way to make certain that you don't miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is to sign up to get it on your email. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and you will find a big yellow box. Shows up all the time on the computer, some of the time on your phone, but if you look, you can find it. Just put in your first name and an email address, and every week, you will get an email from us with a short description of the show's content and a link to that week's episode. And you can also help us, especially with your local stories. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember always, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, especially with the International Uranium Film Festival coming up, I thank you for whatever help you can give to help us out, and I really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that ignoring the impact of nuclear radiation on our lives and health does not change the scientific facts about what it is doing to us. It just keeps us trapped in the danger of not knowing what we're up against, and thus we have no way out. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.